Hey, Fantastic fans, listen up. I was searching online and I typed in Fantastic Tennis Gifts, as one does, and the Google gods shined brightly down on my search as I discovered an online store full of fun, inexpensive gifts that you must go check out right now. www.racketinc.com. That's www.racquetinc.com. They have everything you need for your tennis playing husband, sister, doubles partner, USTA teammate, doorman, you name it. I ended up buying a bunch of the coolest antique racket wine bottle openers. Never seen anything like it. I even picked up a pickleball court mouse pad for my boss because he's convinced he's a pickleball world champion after playing four times, so he'll love it. You won't be sorry. Check out racketinc.com and their Instagram page, Racket Inc., today for the most unique tennis gifts right now.
Welcome back, tennis fans. I'm John Garica. I'm joined today by one of my very favorite personalities in the tennis Twitter universe, Jonas Sobold. Hello, Jonah.
Hey, John. So happy to be here. I love Fantastic Tennis. You had a great episode last week, so to be on this week to talk tennis with you again, it's always a treat.
Aw, hey, Jonah. That's so fun. I'm glad you're back today. I want to give you a compliment because I feel like if tennis Twitter was a high school, you'd be the one at the table that everyone's coming up to and kind of giving all the tea to because... You know all the players. You follow everybody. You follow every player. You know ATP, you know WTA, you know them all. So your player memory is very extensive. So I appreciate you sharing your tennis brain with me today. So welcome back.
Thanks, John. I mean, it doesn't hurt the fact that I really love tennis, especially women's tennis, and I love watching it.
I know.
Don't tell my boss, but I don't think they listen to this show, but I definitely use one of my monitors to watch Tennis Channel live. So
yeah, you're watching during the day?
Occasionally.
Don't worry. I think most people out there, maybe some people out there, I don't know. We'll see. Maybe we should do a poll. I wonder now if people are sneaking peeks of tennis during the day. Well, I do want to start today by setting up this episode because this is unlike most of the episodes we've done player-wise. So I appreciate you stopping by today because I'm really excited for today, especially. Today's episode's a roller coaster. We're going to talk about it in a minute. But first, I really want to give some love and some appreciation to our sponsor this week, Racket Inc. They have been so kind to sponsor our last six episodes, and I absolutely love them. Hopefully you've heard the ad at the start of the show. I just want to say publicly, thank you to the team at Racket Inc. I'll say it again, www.racketinc.com, because without sponsors like them, I'm not sure the show could even be on the air because I do all of this solo and without any support. So I'm not a part of any kind of podcasting network or anything. And to have a sponsor as great as Racket Inc. means that I can bring you more episodes. So thank you very much, Racket Inc., because I love bringing stories to your ears like the one today.
I also really love their pens. Highly recommend Racket Inc.'s tennis racket pens, everyone. Genuinely mean it.
I mean, yeah, let's hype them up for a second because if you need a tennis gift out there, if anybody listening is a tennis fan, obviously you are, check out the website because they have a lot of cool and unique gifts. I just ordered a very cool antique tennis racket bottle opener for my girl Madison Brengel. It's probably my favorite thing on their website. By the way, speaking of Madison, on Twitter this week, Jonah, she kind of went viral a little bit. She had her moment because she had this great moment in Linz where, I mean, she's relatable on a daily level, but this was very Madison Brengel this week. What would you think of that moment? That was very
fun. Yeah, I think all credits to Donna Vekic for hitting incredible drop shots, but at the same time, Madison Brengel is obviously one of the funniest players on the WTA tour, and we're very grateful for her because she makes us laugh. And she's also fierce and very competitive. And what's not to love?
I know, what's not to love? These are one of those moments where I'm like sneaking, I'm leaving a meeting and I pull up my phone just to check the scores and I'm trying to watch the match. So, and I see, you know, Donna's hitting drop shot after drop shot, which Maddie is super fit. So I'm like, okay, all right. And then I couldn't hear it. I didn't have the volume up, but then I see it later on Twitter and it was like, you are so fat. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I've said that probably 20 times in my matches. So
very relatable.
Relatable, you know, always. But if you do love tennis, and I know you do, check out their website. I also bought these very cool tennis cocktail napkins and tennis racket cocktail stirrers, tons of tchotchkes, tons of gifts to sift through if you're on the website. So thank you, Racket Inc. Also, just FYI, if anybody out there has a company that wants to sponsor an episode, I mean, hit me up on Instagram for sure at Fantastic Tennis Pod. I'd love to chat. Jonah, before we jump into the episode this week, I always love hearing your take on tennis. And it was was another great week. We're getting ready for the Middle East. We're playing some great tournaments this week. It's my favorite time of the year. It's the Sunshine Double coming up. I mean, I did the Sunshine Double last year. We were in Indian Wells last year together. It's coming quick. So this is the lead up, right?
It's really exciting.
It's so exciting. It's so exciting. And there were some great matches this week. I'd love to pick your brain. I'd love to know your favorite ATP and WTA moment this week. We'll start with ATP. What's going on in the ATP universe for you?
For me, I'm super excited for the Delray Beach Open, the ATP event that's happening, and I am actually getting to go to the Taylor Fritz match. I can't wait.
Oh, you're going? You're going to an ATP match?
I cannot wait. I'm going to try to abstain myself from getting Morgan Riddle's autograph, Breakpoint Star, so...
I'm waiting for a selfie on Twitter with Morgan Riddle. I mean, that's going to happen, right?
It's probably going to happen this year.
Okay. It's probably going to happen. All right. Stay tuned for that. So you're going to Delray Beach next week. That's awesome. That's fantastic. So you'll be back and giving us all the moments. Isner, Wolf first round, that draw came out. That looked really juicy. That's like a changing of the guards. Like
I know.
The older kind of ATP American man versus the new mullet wearing young warrior stallion. We'll see how that goes. We also have
Ben Shelton's
back, and
Marcos Giron. You got Tommy Paul is back.
Yeah, it's a great lineup in Delray. So have super fun there. I can't wait to hear all about it. Let's get to the ladies though. What was your favorite WTA moment this week? So many
incredible Abu Dhabi moments. I will have to probably start with the incredible Danielle Collins Penko match, where there may have been a potential person in the stands that may have been really close to Ostapenko's camp that may have said something to Danielle that made Danielle really upset in the third set. And it was just before a 15-minute game that they had at 3-all.
Yeah.
That eventually Danielle lost 7-5 in the third, and they had a fantastic handshake. And unfortunately,
it didn't go Danielle's way.
It didn't go Danielle's way, but it went Penko's way. And
it was a great match. I mean, we're talking two of the great personalities on the WTA tour. So everyone circled that match. That was a center court rumble for sure.
By the way, John, did you see the incredible point at 4-all 40-15 in the third set between Beatrice Hedadmaya and Yulia Putintseva? It was the second round of the quarterfinals in one of the best matches of the century, if you ask me.
7-6 in the third, that match?
Yes.
Yeah? Craziness. I know. I love it. It's a really good solid week for the WTA this week, I would say. We're getting ready for Doha. Vika with a wild card. Kenin with a wild card. Ipak Oz with the wild card. I mean, there's no Ons Jabeur, so here we go. You know, I do like it. I think Ipak got the wild card last year too, but in light of what's happened in Turkey and Syria this past week with those earthquakes, I mean, it's great. I really am cheering for her this week.
Same here.
Well, good picks as always. You know, your nose is on the Twitter world. Well, it's showtime, Jonah. Let's talk, because we're highlighting a player today whose story I'm so honored to tell. And I'm not going to lie, you may need a cocktail when you're listening. We have Jamila Wolf, formerly Gaidasova, on the show today. Do you have a favorite Jamila Gaidasova match? I mean, I know she got to 25 in the world. We're going to talk about a lot of things today. She won WTA titles. She was an ITF queen. She won so many titles on that tour. She won a Grand Slam and doubles. I mean, so many highlights in her career.
My absolute favorite moment had to be her fourth round match against Venus Williams at Wimbledon. Her tenacity showed. She lost 6-4, 7-6. But she played incredible. And to play Venus Williams at Wimbledon and to lose 6-4, 7-6 in the fourth round, which was the best she's ever performed at a slam, goes to show that she really, truly had a lot of talent.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That 2010 year, we're going to talk about it. She made the fourth round of the French Open. She follows it up with a fourth round of Wimbledon playing Venus. We talk about this match, too. I mean, obviously, it's a big match for her in her career, playing the queen, Venus Williams, at Wimbledon. Hello. I mean, this is a moment that you don't forget. And, you know, it's such a great show. I mean, I do want to say she's the 2013 Australian Open mixed doubles champion. So that's really great for her. What a feather in her cap. We just celebrated the 10-year anniversary of this Grand Slam. Her story today is so honest. She's extremely vulnerable. While you're listening to this today, please picture her at her kitchen table, and her 5-year-old daughter is literally doing schoolwork right next to her, listening to everything we're saying, and she's playing so quietly for an hour. She's such a great kid. She was just, you know, letting her mom kind of talk and didn't bother her at all. At one point, she gets and sits in her lap, and, you know, Jamila's just being so open. She talks so frankly about being a young teenager on tour, surrounding herself, regrettably, with people known as cowboys, who are these slimy people that try and make profit off of people like Jamila and take advantage of someone like her. And she talks candidly about losing her mother at a tournament and going absolutely numb as she played through the 2013 Australian Open, winning the title so unexpectedly. I mean, the entire 2 weeks was a complete blur to her. At one point, the conversation gets pretty emotional, and you're going to hear me completely breaking down and crying during this episode as well. I mean, there was definitely tears. And it's exactly why I love doing the show. You know, it was a great piece on someone that's spent 16 years on tour. It's completely unfiltered. It's someone who's been away from the tour for a few years and can really have a great mindset to look back and look at her experiences and what she was able to accomplish. And I'm so proud of today. And I really hope that if you're listening out there and you enjoy this episode, please show her some love as well. She's brand new to Instagram. She talks about social media, and we're going to talk about why she stayed away from Instagram for so very long too, because the hate that she would get on social media after losing matches, we go into that as well. And it was really, just really emotional. It really was. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it. And Jonah, thanks for joining today. As always, great to see you. And thanks for being a part of this. And I hope you enjoyed today's episode too. We're giving you Getting to Know Jamila Wolf. Enjoy the show.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
I mean, they always have a big mouth. They always talk a lot. So it happened before, it's going to happen again.
Whether you remember our guest today as a wolf or a Gaida Sova, tennis history books will remember her as a Grand Slam champion. As today we celebrate the 10-year anniversary of her unexpected run to the 2013 Australian Open Mixed Doubles Championship with countryman Matthew Ebden. As a teen phenom, she'd play her first pro tournament just days after her 14th birthday back in 2001, and wouldn't take very long to make her way up the WTA rankings. Her steady play and all-court game would help her win a combined 24 ITF singles and doubles titles on four different surfaces, which made her a dangerous opponent on every court she'd play on. Her game troubled the best in the world, and it would help her finish with three career WTA titles and ultimately reach world number 25 back in May of 2011. But even more impressive are the players she'd beat to get there, including Grand Slam champions like Angelique Kerber, Francesca Schiavone, and Samantha Stosur. She'd announced her retirement from the game in 2017, and she's here today to reminisce with me on a career that saw her play professional tennis for 16 consecutive years. Our guest today is the fantastic Jamila Wolf. Jamila, welcome to Fantastic Tennis.
Thank you for having me. All those things you read just make me feel really old.
Can you believe I just said it's been a 10-year anniversary for your Australian Open title? I think that's nuts. Happy anniversary, by the way. I'm sipping some champagne to you today.
Thank you. Lucky you. I need to get something, but I have kids here, so it's too early for me.
It's never too early, you know, especially when you have kids. That's a good excuse.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere, as they say, right? In the country song.
I definitely want to talk about that crazy run in Melbourne a little bit later. But I wondered, I know you've been retired for a few years now. Does it feel like just yesterday that you were on the court, or does tennis seem like a lifetime ago for you? So much has changed in your life.
It depends. It feels like yesterday from the playing point of view, but also it feels kind of like a lifetime considering that I have a 5-year-old and 2-year-old. So my life's changed pretty much since the day I retired, and I found out I was pregnant with my daughter about 2 months later. And funny enough, I actually ran a half marathon with my sister-in-law, like 9 weeks pregnant, and I was wondering why it felt so awful, and then I knew why.
Hey, Serena did it. You did it too. I mean, it can be done. There we go. Powerful.
It can be. I did it, and I said I'd never do it again, so here I am. So yeah, it feels a little bit while ago, but you know, it had its charm. It had the good things, the bad things that came with it, the things that I'm proud of, and the things that hopefully my kids get to see and learn something from it.
Yeah, we'll talk about your kids too. It's so crazy to think back to 2013, right? 10 years just zipped right by. It's crazy. Some things don't change. Victoria Azarenka and Novak Djokovic won the singles that year, and they're still playing amazing tennis today, really fantastic tennis. Do you remember who won the boys' junior title that year?
Honestly, I don't know if you knew this, but I don't remember that much from it because in September 2012, my mom passed away. So actually, I wasn't even sure if I was going to play Australian Open. And my dad and my brother and his family came to watch me to see if I can make it through. And that month was kind of a, I wouldn't call it a blur, but I literally started doing any physical activity at all in about October, beginning of October. So I haven't really trained that much because it was kind of a more of a mental process more than the physical part. So then I decided now my mom would want me to play. So I played. So there was a lot that went with it between the trainings and trying to deal with the mental state of it. And so unfortunately, I don't remember as much of it, except that I did win it. And that I've seen it actually on TV. I had to rewatch the matches because there was, as I say, a lot of things, you know, that was dealing with lots of depression and anxiety and everything that came kind of with it. It was a lot of help from my psychologist, from all the people around me to kind of get me through that week or the weeks in Australia, because, you know, it's always hardest to play at home.
That story is amazing, Jamila. I mean, obviously, I didn't know the backstory. That's so powerful to share that. Thanks for sharing that today. I mean, I can imagine how numb you would feel for those 2 weeks, just really playing and using tennis as a vessel as to what your mother would really want for you. What an ode, what a beautiful journey. I mean, I have goosebumps right now, even hearing that story. That's so amazing. I can't wait to talk. We're going to talk a little bit later about 2013 and your run there. And now knowing that backstory, I think, that's powerful. That's a very—
And now you have 10-year anniversary for more things.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You know, but that's tennis though. You know, tennis is something that, that connects us, and it really, it's tennis therapy too, for me. I mean, it's my therapy.
Exactly.
Well, let's go back into that later because I definitely want to touch on that. 10 years, obviously it's a little more important for you as we think about the 10-year anniversary now of that tournament. I was doing the research for the show and I was thinking back, and I was doing the research for 2013 and I looked and I saw it was Nick Kyrgios who won the boys title that year, beating Kokkinakis.
That's right. Beating Kokkinakis in the final. That's right.
And I thought, wow, what a great year for Australia, having all these with you and Ebden winning and the boys. And it was so great. And then just started Breakpoint this past weekend on Netflix. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to watch it.
I've seen it actually. We were just watching some kind of a cartoon. So I just saw it that it popped on.
It was really cool to watch and to know the history. When I think back to, you know, 2013 and seeing them both play each other in that final, I thought, oh, wow, how interesting. This show is even more interesting now knowing their backstory. And then in the second episode, I found it really interesting because I thought of you because it featured your former doubles partner, Ayla Tomjanovic, and her journey as an Australian. And I thought, as I researched this, here's another amazing player with a big game who was born in another country, Croatia for her, Slovak Republic for you. And you both start playing for a country that not only had a very rich tradition of tennis, but also had one of the biggest tournaments in the world. I mean, the pressure you must have felt, it was completely different probably from playing in Bratislava.
Yeah.
Can I ask you what it was like playing as an Australian in Melbourne? Was there a different kind of pressure for you over the years there? 2013 aside, because I really want to go into that, but was that a tough place for you to play?
Well, you know, they used to make fun of me that it took me almost 9 years to win that first round at the Australian Open, right? And the more they talked about it, the harder it got. To be fair, I did have the worst first rounds from like Kirilenko, Sugiyama, Vikmaier. Like I literally went between seats 1 and 10.
You forgot Serena. You played Serena there.
Serena, Kerber, like you name it. So literally I played seats between almost 1 and 10 or 1 and 15 almost every single year to start off. And, you know, it wasn't the most kindest beginnings. It was hard. Like I played well, we studied well in Sydney. I made quarterfinal. I won Hobart. I played Hopman Cup. You know, always pretty decent. I won doubles titles. I won all this. So you would think that, you know, Australian Open, here I come. And somehow, as much as I played for me, I think the biggest worry was always that I'm going to let everybody else down.
Yeah.
And everybody puts such hopes in you because they love their sports. They love their tennis. So when you walk on it, the hopes in the next Australian winning, it's so huge that as much as it helps you and empowers you and it supports you and you feel like you feel the love, you also feel that pressure and the letdowns and all the things that they've wrote about you. Like it brings you down. So we love playing at home. I loved playing at home, but I also it was the worst month of the year.
Yeah.
From that point, like once you finished it, you almost were like, okay.
Yeah, the pressure. You can just breathe.
It's done. Now we can play. Like, okay.
Yeah, that's out of the way. That's out of the way.
It didn't work out. I was really bad, but you know what? I tried my hardest. I did what I could. Let's just learn from me and see if I can get some better results, you know, coming up. But I mean, no matter what happened, I always tried to do so well. And I think that was always the biggest issue, that I tried so hard. Like all my preparation, everything was going for that match. Every time I stepped, if it was in Brisbane, I played well in Brisbane. If it was in Sydney, Hobart, Hopman Cup, whichever it was, I tried so darn hard that it was so terrible. Ugh. I played so terrible at times that I couldn't believe it that I can even do that.
Oh my gosh, we're getting so raw today with Jarmila Wolf. I love it already. We're getting so vulnerable. I'm loving this episode already today. This is really great. With the show starting, I know, on a much deeper path right now, because we've mentioned 2013.
Sorry.
No, it's great. I appreciate it. Let's talk about it, because I feel like what you just said is absolutely important, because, you know, even reading Yelena Dokic's book, Unbreakable, which I highly recommend, by the way, if no one out there has read this, please go read Unbreakable.
Well, I know Yelena well. So.
Of course. I mean, amazing champion. But she also talks in the book the same as you. You know, she says, I prepared and I really didn't want to let down the Australian fans. And there was always so much pressure on herself to do well there in Australia.
Well, I started so early. I was 14, so I've been in the country. I wasn't born there, but I've literally played my whole career pretty much since I turned pro and was in there. So it was home, even if, you know, I'm not born there and I'm not the true Australian, but still I called it a home and I tried to do the best I could for the country and play in the country. And
yeah.
People always thought like, oh, they're just excuses. Well, they may be for people, but for us, it's a real thing. I'm not asking to excuse my performance. I did what I could. And if the people thought so or not, that's up to them to decide. But unless you are actually standing on that court and you are watched by all those people and you mm-hmm. read and see the things they say about you afterwards, and that you can experience year after year, if you did well, they'll love you. And it is the best feeling ever. Like when I won the Australian Open, when I did well in Sydney, when I won the Hobart title, when I played with Leighton in Hopman Cup, all that, it felt amazing. Like you felt like the god is walking on the court.
Mm.
But then also if you fail, then, you know, suddenly you're the crazy person who doesn't know how to play. And that felt pretty bad. So it was a hard balance to kind of go with. And some years you deal with it better than the others. And then also there's a lot of things that happens in between that people don't know, and you still walked on the court smiling like nothing happened, nothing is wrong.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part, that you still have to go out there and perform. It is my job, yes. And I get to pay to do it, yes. I'm very lucky to do what I do for a living, you know, so I shouldn't complain. But also, I mean, I was 14 when I started. Imagine a 14-year-old girl trying to go through all these things without any kind of learning,
yeah, absolutely,
you know, process in it. You just kind of throw it in there like, okay, figure it out.
I mean, home is, can I just say, just to recap what you said, because you said so many powerful things there. Home is where the heart is, right? So I completely understand that. So of course, you're Australian. And when we talk about these stories, and this is this is really great today, because tennis fans don't know what you're dealing with. And there's so much going on behind the scenes, and you're dealing with citizenship, and you're dealing with social media, and you're dealing with death. You're dealing with so much. I did read an article years ago about some of the backlash that you would get on social media. You're one of the rare players that really played through a strange generation, because you started really with no social media, mm-hmm. and then social media came on and athletes were being scrutinized and really under a microscope, as we all are. I mean, I can imagine.
Oh, I get that. I got death threats.
So let's talk about it, because I mean, you're raising two children now who are in this generation and dealing with it completely different pressures than even we did.
Oh yeah.
When you say that, I mean, it's crazy. The article I read was, you know, the sensitivity evolved and how, you know, you wanted to step away from social media and how really it was so terrible for you to get that backlash. Was that really difficult for you, kind of being a pro athlete and having to deal with the negativity like that? Obviously.
Oh, honestly, like if I didn't have a social media, I would have been so much better. But then one way or the other, something would find you. If it was the news outlets, the TV, the press conference after the, you know, matches, like somebody always kind of picked on you. Like I could have said one thing and next thing I read the same article to what I just said and it's completely something else. And you're like, hey, you twisted that. I did not say that. So suddenly I was the bad guy again because I was saying, you know, so it was hard. But again, every athlete, I think in every sport, goes through it. It's not easy or it's not ideal. But in other hand, also without the social media, we wouldn't be able to be with the fans.
Yeah.
And there are the fans who are the true fans who really stick by you through the bad, the good, and the ugly. So it's kind of between both worlds. So you want to be part of those lives, because in a way, I had people who I helped, or the people who started playing tennis because of I played, or who enjoy watching me, and I just brought them pure joy. And I love that. That's why I play, because I enjoy those people. And I love when they watch me play and they had a, you know, good time, and even no matter if I won or lost. But then you had the other side where you have people who just literally call me a crazy that I should go see a psychiatrist because I can't handle myself on court and I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, like, how did you figure that from sitting like 20 levels up in the stands? That's what mm-hmm. you figured right now. Like,
did you get better with that as your career went on? Was that something that you handled better toward the end of your career? Or was that always something that you just never kind of dealt with?
It started well, then things happened in life.
Yeah.
When it got really hard, then it got better. Then I kind of moved like over it a little bit, like, okay, well, I can't do this. They took the joy out of it.
Yeah.
Like from me, like literally from my tennis. I quit when I was 16 years old. I actually quit playing. I said, I'm not doing this.
Wow.
I played Australian Open Juniors, my last junior tournament, and I lost first round and I said, I'm done. I quit.
Are you just feeling, oh my gosh, like the pressure? Because you were a great junior. We're going to talk about your career in a moment. You got to six in the world on the ITF rankings. You were a phenomenal junior. What's the stressor that we're talking about?
It was a lot of things. It was like the people who were supposed to be on my side.
Mm-hmm.
If it was part of your team, if it was the people who are sponsoring you, if you was, mm-hmm. you know, like they're bringing you down because you were not fulfilling their expectations. So suddenly you were not their top person, or I didn't look certain way, or I just lost too many matches in a row, or my clothes didn't fit the way they're supposed to, or
pick.
Yeah. Like whatever it was, like they didn't take in consideration. Like I was 14, 15, 16 years old, 16-year-old girl. Like it's not like I'm like a, you know, veteran over there that I've been doing this. So people didn't quite kind of go with me with the changes. They just like threw me in there and they just expected like, mm-hmm. oh, there you go. She's going to win everything she touched. So it was hard from that perspective. And because they saw the glimpse, because I was, you know, decent at the juniors and I was winning and I was doing well at the ITFs already, winning some 25s and 10s. And I was, I think, like 160 or something in the world, or 140 or something like that. They saw the glimpse of, you know, I qualified for the slams and things like that. So suddenly when it didn't continue for whatever reason, because I had to still adjust my game, I had to still learn my game. Yeah, I had the powerful strokes, I had big serve and whatnot, but that can get you only so far. I had to kind of regroup what I was doing and figure out how to play the big girls. Like I was coming from junior suddenly to a big league and that wasn't enough.
Mm.
And nothing was good enough. And that part that nothing was good enough, I think was the pressure that I had on me that just took the whole joy out of playing completely. And next thing, it was a job. That wasn't why I was doing it. I didn't want to do it for that. So it took me about a year before I decided to step back on the tennis court. And then after training for a while, I decided to play my first 25 in Italy, which I did win singles. And after that, I was like, okay, I think I can do this again. Let's do this for a little bit.
That confidence, you know, that. So if we're thinking back to that early time, if we're giving a glimpse into Jarmila as 16 and 17, if you're giving her some advice right now, are you saying, you know, you need a stronger base around you? You need a little more, you need more people that are going to look out for you and not take advantage and kind of build you up so that you're not feeling like every week is just like, oh my gosh, if I don't win, I'm out, I'm done. Yeah, that's a lot of pressure to have on someone's shoulder.
There's definitely a lot of people around who we call the cowboys, who kind of go there when everything is shiny and go away when it goes down.
Yeah.
As I say, all the decisions I made in my early stages of tennis career were kind of made by me, obviously my parents, but they were not traveling with me, so they couldn't see everything and they couldn't know everybody. So they talked to me about it and I kind of made the decisions based on what I thought was right. So all the decisions, the good, the bad, the ugly, kind of came with it. And unfortunately, I wasn't very good in, I guess, picking yet on who the right people were.
No.
And it took me a few years to kind of figure it out. And there were things happened that shouldn't happen to a 14-year-old girl yet. that's why if ever my kids ever play, especially my daughter, she's never going alone, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, the sad part to this story is that this is not dissimilar from so many people we've heard, right? And the fact that you can talk about it today and be so powerful and share this message with your daughter, who's, by the way, I know everyone out there listening, you can't see right now, but her daughter is in the same room with her and she's being very open and sharing this right now. What a great mom you are that you can kind of be open and say, hey, by the way, you know, there was a lot that I felt like I couldn't handle. And that's okay to say. That's okay. That's really beautiful.
It is. We try to teach them all the right things. And if I'm going to lead by the example, if I can't admit it when I made a mistake, how can she's going to tell me, no, mommy, I did that. Like, so I need to do the right things. But plus, I've done this for a long time. As you say, I played for 16 years, as you reminded me, unfortunately. And I had to learn the good that came with it. And I have to realize the bad things that came with it. And when I retired, everybody was like, well, are you proud? I'm like, yeah, I'm proud. But I also wish that all those years that things were going wrong, somebody would have stepped up and tell me why or try to help me to fix it instead of me kind of going through it on my own and trying to figure out how to get out of it. I mean, there were years that I traveled alone. So like, for example, I played Tokyo tournament and my semis. I was there on my own and every warm-up I did was against the wall because I had no one to hit with.
These are the things that we just don't hear or really understand when it comes to these players that we pick on. You just never know. You just never know. I mean, we're going to learn so much today. I feel like you've been so open right now in this conversation. And yes, we've started very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, that's why today is important.
Look, everything is positive. Don't get me wrong. Like the things that happened and the things I've been through, in a way, they tell me what I am now. And they show me how, you know, what I can learn from and how to change it or what to look out for if my kids ever decides to do any kind of sport or anything they want to do in life. Overall, like if that didn't happen to me, I wouldn't be what I am now. Yeah, there are some scars that came with it and, you know, different memories that I wish they were not there. But outside of that, I got to do what I love to do for a living. I got paid to do it. Yeah. I got to travel, see the world that like 90% of people never get to do. I got to meet some wonderful people, some amazing people with talents, smart people, and different kind of things that I wish my kids get to see. There is always a positive. At the time, I was not able to see it because I was too, not even sad about it, but just too down about it to kind of, you know, you just saw what was right in front of you. But overall, I am proud of what I've been through and what I've done. But would I change a few things? Definitely, I would change. Could I have been better? Maybe. Maybe I could have. I don't know.
Absolutely. This is tennis therapy today for sure. So all your fans are listening out there to understand really, you know, this great career that you had and what was going on behind the scenes. So thanks for sharing today. This is going to be a great episode. All right. I want to start today and jump into your career because you had so many great highlights. I always start with this first question and it gives me an idea as to who you are, where you are, how old you are. I always love to know what was the first tennis match you remember watching live or on television?
Good question. Steffi Graf and Monica Seles, I think.
Oh, yeah. Like French Open? We're talking.
I love Monica on TV.
Yeah.
My first live match was probably Serena playing Venus at a US Open when I played the juniors. First live match that I, like a professional match, I played at the age of 12 when we had the WTA tournament in Bratislava. And I played, her last name was Schwartz, I think.
She's Barbara Austrian, Schwartz.
I believe. Yeah. I actually won and I lost second round in qualies.
She had a very crazy game, if I remember, Barbara Schwartz. Yeah.
Yeah. If you want to count that as the first professional match I've seen, then that will be it.
Okay. All right. I'll take that. I'll take that. You grew up in a tennis family or no? I know, obviously.
Oh, no sport. Well, to be fair, my brother was a professional snow skier. So my brother did that. My dad kind of played soccer. Well, football, I should say, not soccer. And my mom, bless her heart, she had to be the most uncoordinated person I know.
So you're a blessing then. You know, the genes aren't there, so that's good.
They're definitely from my dad. Like my brother and me definitely got it from dad. My mom was super smart. She had chemistry and biology degree. So, but the tennis, I just started playing by luck. My mom's best friend was the first coach I ever had who actually taught people like her buddy, Kuchera, and Hapshudova, Nadjova, all these people when they were little. So she was my first coach because I actually didn't make it into the club when they picked the kids. I never made the clinics.
Wow.
Yeah, I could apparently hit the ball against the wall, but I could hit it over the net, so I didn't get picked. So, so she said, well, I take you. So I actually played only once a week for an hour every Sunday with her till I was 9.
Okay.
And then she couldn't handle it with me anymore because she was obviously an older lady. And then I had a new coach till I was about 12.
Well, you were way, way better at 12 than any other 12-year-old. I mean, you were talking about your impressive junior record now, because as a junior, you'd make the Australian Open junior semifinal, you'd make the Wimbledon junior semifinal, the US Open junior semifinal. We mentioned it a little earlier. We get to 6th in the world. I mean, in the ITF junior rankings. For people listening out there, I do wonder, I know we've talked a little bit about how you became who you are today and some of the lessons you learned. When you're a junior, are sponsors knocking on your door at 6th in the world? Are you getting these cowboys? Is that typical in the junior world that they're coming and saying, oh, you know, who's the next crop of young junior players that we can just start marketing and getting?
No.
Is that typical these days? No?
Not at all, actually. I had none.
Okay. So you did this on your own?
My parents paid for everything.
Okay.
And it also depends mainly where you're from. I was from a small country of 5 million people that really didn't televise. Tennis, as much as good of a country we are when it comes to tennis players, like very good. Fortunately, it wasn't big enough, you know, for the people to kind of jump on a train. So for a while, my parents paid for it. And then once I turned pro, actually, I paid for the rest.
I mean, you know, thank you to the parents that really kind of said, hey, you know, mom and dad, thanks for letting me live my dream. I want to do this, you know, let me do it.
And then I got lucky that since 14, 15, pretty much, they didn't have to. I was the one that actually made the rest. And then obviously Australian Federation helped as well. And they put a funding into it. And I was able to train at the Australian Institute of Sport. I could use the Melbourne facility. But for a while, obviously, I had to find my own way for a little bit.
You started playing ITF events all the way back in 2001, as you said, and you'd finally turned pro in 2005. We talked about the journey that it took for you to get there. I mean, there was so many demons that I'm sure you've had to really kind of come to terms with over the years and all the things that really led you to starting a pro career. And it was really tough. And to get there, it's even greater when you're earning that first paycheck. You'd won that tournament in Italy.
I did.
And you did get your first paycheck. Do you remember that?
I did.
Yeah. Do you remember? What'd you buy with your first
paycheck? Ice cream.
I mean, there we go. Now we're talking.
No, honestly, I had an ice cream and tiramisu.
Now we're talking. Now, you know, maybe we're related. Who knows? I don't know.
Maybe. Not the same.
By the end of 2005, you'd be as ranked as high as 147 in the world, already cracking the top 150. You'd continue to really climb up the rankings. Each year, you kept improving, making progress. You'd win bigger matches. I know rankings are a big stressor for most players. Was ranking a big stressor for you each week? Is that something that you thought about?
Not really. I mean, my main goal, I wanted to play main draw of the slams. This is going to sound really silly, but for the longest time, I really didn't know how many points any tournament has or how it works when it's falling off and it's coming back in or any of that stuff. Like even the prize money, I had absolutely no idea how much I'm making per round. If you would have asked me, I would have probably just give you a number just to say something because I wouldn't honestly know what it was until the actual paycheck came to me. So,
well, let's break this down because, of course, I mean, you're traveling the world by yourself as a teenager, right? You're booking your own flights, you're getting to Japan, you're getting your paycheck. And, you know, these are things you're learning on the cuff. I mean, this is
pretty much
crazy, right? This is the college of the world, right? This is where you went to school. You went to World College, is where you went.
I did.
If rankings weren't the bigger stressor to you on the tour, what was the biggest stressor throughout your career? Was it, you know, when you're traveling by yourself, was it just the day in day, just kind of navigating, becoming an adult by yourself, like traveling? Or
I think so. It was funny enough, the traveling, like, once you figure it out once, like after that, it kind of becomes pretty straightforward. Like you keep we are creatures of routines, the tennis players. You kind of do the same things over and over again until that's all you know, right? But I think the toughest part, it wasn't even the traveling as much as the things, if things happen in between, to kind of try to figure out like how I want to deal with that. And then yet I had to go to the next tournament and concentrate on that suddenly. And so like the normal life, things probably were the hardest. I always said that tennis itself was actually the easiest part to do because you trained it. It's like when you ride a bike, right? You don't forget it. But because we are creatures of habits and we are emotional, especially girls, we are very emotional. We are very invested. We put our heart and soul. Not that the guys don't, but, you know, we are still a little bit more up there. It just makes it difficult to kind of go through all the emotion and still be okay and trying. So the life itself, it's probably the hardest to navigate. The tennis was like a little little bubble that you got to put yourself in, and nobody else mattered because it was all about you and all about what you need to do and all about your game and all about, you know, what you eat, where you eat, when you go sleep. Everything was you. But then suddenly something happened in life and you're like, oh, hang on, well, what do I do with that now? Like, that's, they threw me off my bubble now. They burst my bubble and I don't know how to get it. Mm-hmm. So that probably was the hardest.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it is lonely. You have friends and you have people around all the time and people think like, well, they're all these tennis players. Like, no, we have friends. Okay. But it doesn't mean that y'all hang out every day and you go to dinners and parties. No, tennis is, you train, you play, you go back to your room, watch a movie, whatever, have a massage, go to dinner, go sleep, and you repeat. Mm-hmm. It's not like we have a girls club going on that we go and, you know, have a party. You have your close friends or few friends, but that's not quite. So you spend 35 weeks a year looking after yourself and doing things for yourself. So suddenly you don't also learn how to grow up like the normal kids do, like the social aspect of it, that like you'll learn that on the go. So if you don't learn it, suddenly you reach like, you know, 26 years old and you still don't know almost how to hold a conversation. So it's kind of a life, I think the life itself, that suddenly when something happens, you quite didn't know what to do, and the loneliness of it itself, because we are not a team sport. As much as people think we are friends, we are. But it's not the same as when you have a team of 16 guys traveling together every week, training together. Like, they can support each other. We're here, you know, like I have one friend still there, I still talk to now, that she still, you know, calls and comes and visit and whatnot. But that's all. If you imagine after 16 years, there's one.
Who's your ride or die? Who is that?
Gabby Dabrowski. Yeah.
I mean, she's the best. The best. I love Gabby Dabrowski for sure. Well, it took you a few years to get to that point because you were navigating on your own and in your own waters. But by 2006, you'd win your first WTA doubles title in Sweden. And I have to quickly note that you beat the best team in the world to do it, Ji Zhang and Yan Zi, who had won the Australian Open and Wimbledon title in 2006. I mean, if you're going to beat somebody, I'm giving you an air high five for that one. That's a big
one. Thank you. That tournament was crazy, though. The whole how I won it, it's mind-boggling. It really is.
Why? What was the story? I mean...
No, I think quarterfinal, I think I was playing Alicia Molling and Lena, I believe.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
I managed to hit Lena out of a return, like, real hard. And I felt terrible for the rest of the match. And I was playing Alicia, which, funny enough, my first quarterfinal of a tournament, I played Budapest. Mm-hmm. And I qualified, and I played Alicia in quarterfinal as a 12-year-old girl, a 13-year-old girl, still with Dave Taylor as a coach. And then suddenly I was playing her on the other side after I just started. I'm like, I remember you. And then I hit Lena from all people, like as hard as I could from Alicia's like a second serve. So I felt bad. We ended up winning that. And then the final, we play Ji Zhang and Yan Zi, and we would go indoors. I'm like, oh, great. This is going to be so fast. Like, oh, my goodness. So we start playing, and we are getting absolutely wiped off the floor. Like, it was crazy. And we had all the people, like, cheering, you know, everything. I'm like, oh, my goodness, we got to do something. And then Yan Zi, she crosses at the net, and he hits a swinging volley, and she hits me right in my abs. So I go down.
No way.
In a shock, like I'm like catching my breath, trying to figure out like what's going on. So everybody, like everything just went quiet, right? So she comes over. She's like, oh, sorry, I didn't mean it. I'm like, huh, okay. I'm still just trying to like breathe out, like trying to figure out like how I'm going to get back to it. And I don't know what possessed me, but about a game later, I think it was like 6-0, like 2-1 down or something silly like that. And like a game later, my doubles partner, she's like, you okay? I'm like, yeah. And I'm about to kick their for that. You know, like I got so mad.
Yeah. You saw red.
I'm a Taurus. So I was as Taurus as I can be. Like I saw red that nobody could see it. And once I realized that, I remember the very next ball, I hit probably the hardest I've hit in my whole life. I missed by like a mile. I didn't even, like, she ducked and the whole crowd were like, ooh. I'm like, okay, I'm out. I'm done. I got it out of my system. But that moment, we figure it out. And after that, it was like one-way train. We just kept going. It just was happening. And thing we know, we just won that final after that.
I mean, getting hit in the throat, we're talking serious now. We're talking Liesl Huber type proportions here. We're talking, oh my gosh. Yeah.
It hurt. Like she was like a foot away from the net. And, you know, she had the double-handed forehands and backhands and she swung. And I was at a net. I think I was just like trying to turn away and somehow it hit me right straight through. I'm like, oh.
But she hit you on purpose, right? Yeah, let's be, all right, come on. We did. Yeah, I mean, that's what you do though, but you can't.
I mean, she's number one in the world, right? She had a full court.
Okay, there we go.
But, you know, no hard feelings. Like I've done it too, as I say, I hit Lena as hard as I could. I mean.
Exactly, that was karma. There we go.
Probably, yeah. I know that I actually fully meant it. I was aiming at her, but I didn't want to hurt her.
What if Lena was like, hey, by the way, next match. Yeah, Yanzi, you got my back, girl? Yeah, you get it. You get you, Jamila.
Oh, she would have. Like, she used to laugh about it for afterwards all the time. Like, yeah, you remember that? I'm like, yeah.
Can I call you Yarka? Yarka's such a cool...
Yeah, okay, of Yarka. Course.
What a good...
I get the Jamila when something official, like if I'm being introduced somewhere.
Exactly. All right. I'd like to take a look at your 2010 season as things would really change for you, Yarka. So let's take our tennis time machine back to 2010. I was listening to Teenage Dream by Katy Perry on my iPod Nano. Yeah. I'm not sure what you were doing, but that was definitely...
I had that. I don't know about the Katy Perry, but I had that.
Okay. All right. Fair. 2010 would arguably be your best year on tour. You'd break into the world's top 50 for the first time. You'd also win your very first WTA title. Let's talk about that moment because we just heard a great story about your title in Sweden. And this one came at a place very far from home. You were in China. You're in Guangzhou. Let's talk about it. You beat Alla Kudryavtseva in that final. After playing on tour for a while, what was that feeling like to finally win a WTA title? Can you remember?
I remember. So again, it was a first tournament after US Open. I went there by myself. I was, for the first time, a top seed at a tournament, at a WTA tournament, right?
Ooh.
Guangzhou is very hot. It's hot, it's humid, it's awesome for me because I love that. The courts are fast, but not like a lightning fast. The court itself, like you can kind of still feel like you're playing with time a little bit, you know, so it's like a good combination. But I was there by myself. My coach went back to Australia. He's like, okay, start with this one. I will meet you when you go to like Tokyo or like the indoor events, right? I'm like, yeah, sure. I mean, you've been with me the whole US tour. Like, go home. I will do this one on my own. So I'm a top seed because Zheng Ji pulled out. She was supposed to be the top seed. I was supposed to be the second. So then they switch us, right? And I played every single day, the same time at the same court. I had no one to warm up with. So it was whoever I found. I had ball kids hit with me. I had all kinds of... Before final, I don't think I even hit with anybody. I just asked for a longer warm up because I had no one to hit with. There was nobody else left.
That's
because
crazy.
It was the final, right?
That's crazy.
But anyway, every day I play at the same time at 12 o'clock. I had not before 12 at a center court. So first match started at 10, you know. So within a minute, I was pretty much on the money. So every day, 12 center court. I had one of those weeks that probably if I closed my eyes, I was going to make that ball inside of a court.
I think you lost five games. You had five. I think that was it. I looked at the scoreline. It was crazy.
It was five. My final, I think, lasted about 37 minutes.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, that's pretty precise. 37 minutes. You must know that. That's a good stat.
It was something similar like that. Like if you don't count the warm up and all the breaks, but I was serving like three aces a game. I mean, I could not miss if you wanted me to. And everything just kind of gelled that every day seemed like a groundhog day. I couldn't believe it. I was waiting for it to stop. But then the sad part of it was that there was almost nobody watching and I was there by myself.
Yeah.
So I won. I'm like, yay. I hit an ace. I'm like, oh. Yay.
It's back to business, right?
I won. So yay, there's nobody almost clapping. I had no one to celebrate it with because it was just me there. So I don't think I even put my like hands up. I was just like, cool.
Wow. Yeah. Can I ask a silly question maybe from, you know, from someone who didn't play pro tennis, but I do, you know, I play tennis as much as I can and I love the sport. And mentally, I think that's the most challenging thing for me. And that's why I'll play until as long as I can, because it really is just such a great exercise of the mind too. I do wonder when you have a situation like Guangzhou, where you're trying to replicate this great play every single, or you are replicating this great play every single day, and you play in the same time, and you're in the zone, and you're feeling like you can't miss a ball, like you said. Are you trying throughout your career to replicate this again? Are you trying to get this feeling? Like, I'm sure at some point when you're losing a match and you're losing back-to-back matches, and then maybe three matches come up, you're going to think about Guangzhou. You're going to say, how do I channel how I was playing then? How do I channel three aces a match and play that way again? I mean, is that something that you kind of think back to in your career?
You do, but it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Like what happened that week, it just everything went right, which in your career, I have a feeling that's what, for example, like the girl's name that just won US Open, the
Raducanu?
Her.
Yeah.
I believe that's what happened to her. Okay. She literally had one of those 2 weeks where somehow everything, like her game is great, right? She's a big ball. She's a great athlete, but everything just kind of
came together.
Gelled and happened right place at the right time.
And you're like, come on, Emma, why was yours in New York and mine's in Guangzhou? Let's go. Still, come on.
It is what it is. Can't pick it. But obviously she has a game for it, you know, so that's not the question if she can do it. It just happened that early and that fast for that long to go for 2 weeks. Of course, I tried to recreate it, but you know how well you can play and you know what it looks like. You play for 80% of the year. You play terrible.
Okay.
You just try to survive it.
Is that true? Is that how you feel? You feel like 80%
of the time? 100%. 80% of the time you try to survive and figure it out a way to keep going. So that's why they say like the top players, that's why they are top, because they find a way to bring their A game to A- to B and still be that great. Mm. It's not that they forget how to play. They somehow find a way to go through those matches that they have to go through and survive the majority of the time. And then when it needs to be, they learn, or they just have that game to step it up and be like, hey, this is me. This is what I actually look like. But the people like the lower rank, we struggle a little bit finding that middle. So like my dad used to say, like I either played in a rooftop or I was in a basement. And it took me a lot of time to figure out the seventh floor, which by the time I played like Guangzhou and everything, I learned my seventh floor.
Mm-hmm.
But then somehow there I was allowed, and I know I could play the rooftop, and I could play match after match. And it was so much fun because I could literally do what I wanted and it was happening. Whereas most of the time I had to suddenly bring it down and kind of going between and finding way if it meant I have to run more, if it meant I have to make more balls, if it meant I have to slow down the serve, if it meant just to literally run and make sure that the ball goes in. Like when I won Hobart, for example. Hobart title was the same thing. Like my final, I played Bethany. I didn't play great. It was the windiest day ever. Like my goal was to get that ball in the middle. So I literally aimed cross court and the wind brought it inside of the middle court and I ran my high knee off. Like that was literally all my goal was. I had no other plans for that final. That's how windy and ugly it was. And unfortunately, or fortunately for me, Bethany wanted to play her style and things were shifting, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just was more solid at the time. But you had to learn over the years on what you can and can't do. But literally, I would say for good 80% of the time, that's your goal. You can train all you want. That has nothing to do with your training, with your preparedness. We play so many matches and so many weeks in and out and traveling and change of conditions and things happening to you and emotions and tiredness and aching and injuries and conditions in general. Like it's windy, it's sunny, it's raining, the court is faster, the balls are like, there's so much that honestly, that's your biggest goal or your hope is that you learn how to navigate all this and still play your seventh floor.
Oh my gosh, seventh floor, rooftop. I love this today. The euphemisms are there. They're solid today. Well, let's talk about your rooftop because 2010, you had your own chair sitting on your rooftop because it was engraved with your name on it because you would play some great tennis that whole year long. Let's talk about that summer, the best summer of your career. You'd make the fourth round of both the French Open and Wimbledon. You beat Angelique Kerber in the third round before playing Venus Williams.
Love that match.
In a very close match. I think it was 4-6.
I love that match.
Was that match on center court?
It was on court one. No, court one. No. The graveyard, the other court.
Yes. Okay. Court two, I guess.
Two.
What memories do you have from that Wimbledon?
I love playing Venus. It was so fun. So usually when I played Serena and I played Venus in Wimbledon before that. So I'm like, oh man, I really have to do something here now. So my brother lives in London, right? So he always comes and watch me, well, tries to his kids as well. And so he always comes and watches. It's kind of a family affair. So that's the one tournament that my parents and my brother actually got to watch me play live. Outside of that, they never traveled with me. So it was always a little bit more, you know, like, let's see if I can do something good here. My dad actually watched a first game, and after that, he kept walking through the whole grounds because he couldn't watch it. So I actually never got to enjoy that match as much as well as I played. I always loved Venus. I used to wear her clothes, right? I was one of the couple players who did that. I think Venus is great. I love Venus. I think she's smart. I think she's down to earth. I think she's a very good role model. I just genuinely liked her every way and shape and form. She was always there if I needed her for anything, if I need advice, if I was struggling, if my clothes didn't fit, she would figure it out to make sure that I feel good in them. Like she was there.
Oh, wow. That's great to hear.
So when I played her, I still remember having her and Serena's posters on in my room in Slovakia. And they still had the beads in their hair. I still have them, by the way. I asked my dad if he took them ever off from my room, and they're still there. So I was very excited. I really had a ball. I was going for it. I remember I made a couple mistakes where I got broken in the first set, like the silliest volley, which until this day, I can't believe I hit that. Like every time I see him, like, you're going to miss it right there. I'm like, yep, she did it. She did it again.
She did it again. The nightmares, the tennis nightmares.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but you know what? It's still, I played really well. I really did. And I will never forget, I was leaving the court with the security, and Mr. Williams came to me and he said, you know, one day you're going to beat them. I'm like, can you tell me how? Now they're my daughters. I cannot do that. I'm like, darn it. For a little girl, like, I was very excited, and I had a ball playing that match. I still watch that match. I showed it to my daughter because it is one of the, it's one of the few matches you can find on YouTube where actually they don't show me in a bad light. So it's not something embarrassing or something bad. But overall, you know, it's Venus. It's Venus. So I really
it's
have
Venus,
no.
The queen.
If I'm going to lose to anybody, I'm as bad as they sound, I'd be happy to do it to Serena and Venus, because their game were money. It was money.
It was money. Yes. Rooftop, Yarka. Well. It was money. It was money. And hey, kudos to Venus this year going all the way to Auckland and winning a round. It's so amazing and inspiring for women and for everybody.
It just shows you how much, if you love a sport, what it can do. Like, she loves it. She's not playing. I mean, she doesn't need to play for anything.
She doesn't need that money.
She does it because she loves it. No, not even that. She doesn't have to show anything. She doesn't have to prove anything. She doesn't have to earn anything. She already done all that. She's doing it because she genuinely loves the sport. And that's great for everybody there.
Inspiring. Oh, let's move on to 2011. You'd start your year by beating the number one Aussie in Brisbane, Samantha Stosur, who played her very last tournament at the Australian Open this year, by the way. She made that announcement.
Oh, she did? She returned? Oh.
Yeah. What a career she's had. So great.
I know.
So
lovely. She's a beautiful baby girl.
So beautiful. After making the quarters in Brisbane, you beat Bethany Maddox-Sands and Hobart. We just talked about that. And Windy Hobart winning your second title.
Yeah.
I'm sure that was much different than your Guangzhou. At least you had, you alluded a little bit to feeling you're back at home, and at least you had some support.
Yeah. I always loved Hobart though. Hobart and Sydney and Brisbane. I always loved playing them. Brisbane was kind of like a second home. It was nice. Like, I always played well. I feel like, I beat Cibulkova there.
Some great wins in Hobart.
I played well against Kvitova in the quarterfinal, which I had chances. Unfortunately, I just didn't take them. So that was fun. That was fun memories from there.
You know, that era from the summer to even the start of 2011, you're playing a different level of tennis. You're playing top tier tennis. You know, you're reaching career highs. You're cracking the top 30 in the world. You get up to 25. That year in Australia, you'd lose to Wickmeyer, who was top 20 in the world at the time. We talked about your bad draws in Australia. So you win Hobart, you go to Australia.
And I was playing a night match.
Oh, it was a night match. I was just going to ask.
I don't like night matches.
Okay.
Don't like that match.
So I wonder, all right, so knowing your history of Australia and, you know, the jabs that you would get from your friends about not winning first rounds, if we're going to pick a first round in Australia to redo, is this the year that you're playing your best tennis at the 2011 Australian Open, coming back, you know, after a great 2010 season? Is that the one you would want to redo and beat Wickmeyer to play Sevastova?
I will do the redo the Kerber one.
Oh, okay. I love that you're greedy. You're like, Wickmeyer was great, but I'm going to go for Kerber.
When I played Angie, I lost the first set. I wasn't playing well at all. As I said, me and Center Courts in Australian Open didn't agree at all with each other. But then, funny enough, in the second set, I sprained my ankle. So I fall, they tape me, and I win the set 6-1. But why I didn't continue doing it beats me until this day.
Doing what? Doing what? Like break the other ankle? You wanted to twist the other ankle so you can.
No, please don't. I already broke it once, so no, thank you. But like, why I changed how I was playing that set? Suddenly the third one started, and I went to the same what I played the first one, and I'm like still thinking until this day. Like, why? Like, what possessed me to do that?
When you're injured and you're compensating like that, what is the method? Where does your head go? Maybe I know it's hard to remember back then, but for people listening, you know, who are avid tennis fans, if you hurt yourself and you're just trying to compensate and you're trying to hit as hard as you can and just
it
kind
depends
of...
what the injury is. Like, if, you know, obviously if you can move, good for you. If it's like a shoulder or something, then you just try to kind of keep it in. If you can't move, you're swinging out. Mm-hmm. But my ankle wasn't like terrible. I mean, it was sprained, but it wasn't terrible because they taped it with a double brown ankle tape, so it held. But I went from how I was playing, like structuring the points, to suddenly it's almost like I got scared and I'm like, no, let's go play ball with her. Let's run and make balls for whatever magic reason.
Yeah. You know, you just try. I get it.
How would I do that?
Hey, Kerber, champion, let's go. I mean, she's one of the best of all time. All right, Jarkko, I want to get to 2013 because you'd have some great things happen that year and maybe some not so great things as well. Let's start with the positive. I want to talk about your Australian Open run because I'm going to say it again. You're a Grand Slam champion. Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Jarkko Wolf. Congrats. I mean, come on, you're a Grand Slam champion. Where's the trophy, by the way?
Right now it's in with Movers in Virginia. But it is in my bookshelf, and my daughter actually polishes this for me because I forget that it's silver.
That's right. Go polish my trophy right now.
Oh, she does it. I don't have to ask. I actually kind of forget because my son puts his Hot Wheels in it.
Okay. So. Oh, wow. Okay, that's very cool. You'd play some great tennis, and you know, we know a little bit of the backstory now that you go into this tournament devastated, and you're really trying to use tennis as a way just to kind of focus on something else, right? This is the mindset going into this Australian Open.
Well, yes and no. It started a little bit like, okay, we're going to do this knowing it's going to be very hard and it's going to be a lot of pressure and I'll have to go through the same questions. Oh, are you going to win the first round? Yeah. Are you going to win? And all that. But also, like, for the most part, I was actually doing pretty well, you could say. I wasn't playing my best, don't get me wrong. I just got a new coach, everything that happened with mom. I was actually finding that I found out about it when I was in Guangzhou. Like an hour before my match, my dad called and my mom died. So I didn't even know. I was like...
Is that true? Right before you went on?
Yeah, I didn't know. And I just got this phone call and I was warming up with... I forgot who I was hitting with. And she looked at me and was like, you okay? I'm like, my mom died. And she didn't know what to do. So she kind of walked me off the court and she told the supervisor, who is actually was really, he was great. And obviously I played a tournament, I don't know, 5 years in a row or something, because I love Guangzhou. It was great. And after that, he asked me if I want to play. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to play, I think. And obviously when I went on court, it was terrible. I played awful. I mean, we could hardly call it a tennis match, really. And then I went to the hotel room after that and let me be for a week. And I remember I had all the WTA officials and everybody like calling me every 2 hours to make sure I was okay. I kept getting all these flowers. They were sending me food and all this. And then I think after that, I flew back to States and then decided... About September, Tennis Australia helped me to find a psychologist to work with, who actually worked with the Richmond Football Club in Australia, in Melbourne. And so I started working with him, which, by the way, he's the best. I love him. He's awesome. And he helped me through a lot. And he pretty much talked to me every day to kind of get me through so I can actually start. So then I start slowly physically and playing. And I mean, when I say slowly, like slowly. And then became... to Australia in December. And, you know, I continue my therapy, played Brisbane. I actually lost my first match. And then one day I remember waking up in the morning and I called my psychologist. I'm like, I'm very unhappy. Like, I can't I can't laugh. I don't want to eat. I don't want to turn on the lights. And I don't want to go outside because everybody makes me uncomfortable. Like, makes me, like, they are looking at me and I don't want to go out. So he's like, yeah, I figured that will come with all the people and everybody commenting on everything, how you play. And it just all kind of like collapsed. And so I actually had to put me on medication. So I was taking lots, very high dosage of the antidepressants, mm-hmm. and which created that kind of like a, I call it the zombie look.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't feel, but I was present to a certain degree, but I have no recollection of it. So I played the tournament and I remember winning it. I don't have feelings from it though, which is really sad. Like I don't remember how it felt when I won that match, but I know I hit backhand down the line to pass the person at the net. I know everybody was jumping and everybody was happy, and I know I was supposed to smile, so I did. I remember I have to do doping after that for 3 hours and a set of intervals on a bike, but I don't remember, unfortunately, anything else about it whatsoever. So people say that I won it, and which I know I did, but unfortunately, I don't remember that. So my memory kind of goes to that match point and the one before that.
Yoko's daughter just popped into the frame as well. On perfect timing, by the way. Perfect timing to give a hug, by the way.
She's a good hugger.
Really good hug. Really good. I wish I could give you a hug right now. I'm so moved right now. I am crying. It's so
I didn't mean to make you cry.
It's just it's so beautiful, really. It's beautiful, really. You know, it's happy tears because your mom was with you those 2 weeks. You know, she wanted you to have a legacy and to say, you know what, I'm here with you always. And this is such a great memory to, you know, from taking something that was so traumatic to morph it into something so positive is so moving. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I've done that too. Don't worry. I'm teared out, I think.
I know. We're getting real today. This is real. You know, these are real things. Tennis is, tennis transcends.
But after that, by the way, I had to stop playing for a while. I played the tournament in Miami and I started feeling really sick. And then because of the antidepressants, I actually then went to Dallas and I fainted on a street. And then they took me to the doctors and they said that my liver, I was shutting down my spleen from all the stress and training and the medication.
Well, yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah. I'm not a doctor. I can tell you that right now.
And then they find out actually I have a mono, right?
Yeah.
So I ended up living, now I live with a chronic mono, so I can't actually get rid of it. So whenever I spike, it kind of goes up and down, and I had to stop doing everything like completely for the rest of the year.
I know the second part of your season, you took 6 months off. You weren't on the court. You got mononucleosis. I mean, gosh, when you're down, someone's kicking you.
But the positive thing is in October that year, I got a puppy.
Oh, okay.
And I have a black lab. And he was 7 weeks old when I got him. And I was living in Dallas because my doctors were then, I had to go every 2 weeks for a blood work to see if my mono is doing okay. And I lived across the street from a dog park where they made the best donuts and breakfast tacos. So I got this puppy. And about 3 days later, there was a guy who drove in a giant red truck with his Saint Bernard puppy in a front seat barking at us. And that guy happens to be my husband, who I have 9 years, 2 kids and 2 dogs.
No, come on. That is all right. I thought really, I thought the end of the story was that you got a St. Bernard and I said, you're nuts.
Well, we had them together for the last 10 years. So together we met there and we pretty much started dating and been together ever since.
There we go.
And I stopped taking the medication after I met him because I decided I want to feel something and I really like this person. And then we are together ever since.
I just want to end the show today. That's how great this is. What a great note to end on. Is he a tennis fan?
Well, he was my tennis fan. He didn't know if I was winning or losing.
That's right. Wait, say that loud and clear. He's my tennis fan. I love that. That's a good hashtag. There we go. That's great. That's great, Yarka. Thank you for sharing that. That's real. Okay, now, you know what? You had me in tears and now I'm smiling. Now I'm happy again. This is great. So I want to go back just real quick then because, you know, obviously this title on paper, let's just talk about on paper, not really in actuality that we just went through this traumatic, you know, but positive and lovely and beautiful and horrible, all these great feelings that we felt for 2 weeks, that quarterfinal with Petrova and Bupati 13-11. I mean, mm-hmm. there's certain things that we're going to have to go back and just kind of talk about. But congratulations to you. I mean,
thank you.
What
thank
an amazing you. Run for to win your Grand Slam title. Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary. Overall, you were a great doubles player in general, and you'd make a couple Grand Slam quarterfinals as well. You had some great doubles partners.
Oh, yeah.
The Rodionova sisters, Sue Wei, you played with. Bethany Maddox-Hands, you played with as well. Isla, a fan on Twitter of yours, at Montclair95, wants to know, what's your favorite doubles moment from your career?
It's a tough one.
It is. I will say, if I had to say, I've seen Anastasia Rodionova play about 10 times, and 9 out of 10 times, there was theater involved. So I'm hoping that that's one of your moments that you, because, I mean, I'm a fan, by the way. I'm not knocking Anastasia Rodionova, but I mean, she was the original Nick Kyrgios. I mean, and I will just say, to defend Anastasia Rodionova, women are not allowed to behave badly, but of course, Nick Kyrgios can do what he wants. And she's going to get all the ridicule. I mean, more props to Anastasia Rodionova. I hope a lot of people come out and, you know, give their feelings on the court like she did. But anyway, all right. Hopefully it's a Rodionova story.
She was interesting to play with. Like, she's a great doubles player. She's a great tennis player, period. She has a very good reading of the game, where to go, what to do, and all this, you know. So we played enough, probably more against each other than together.
Yes.
And when we play against each other, it was always fun.
Fun, she says with a smirk. Yes.
We played London Olympics together, which unfortunately was definitely not one of our good matches at all. And we kind of agreed that we should not play together again.
After the Olympics? That's a lot of pressure, though. Come on, that's a lot of pressure.
After the Olympics. Yeah. Yeah, that was hard. That was hard. But general doubles, I enjoyed playing it. I never felt I was good at it. I felt like I was good as a singles player, but I was never good playing the doubles as a doubles player. I could hold my own. That's why I think I played well in mix, because I could hold my own when it came from serving, returning. I had no volleys, very good volleys, but I could hold them. Like, if somebody went at me, I could make them, I could cross, I could hit overheads. So nothing like stands out like, oh, I did so-and-so, you know? So it's kind of a hard one.
Yeah, I hear you. We're wrapping up today with Jarmila Wolf Yarka. Can we talk about the R word for one moment? Because it's always a crazy conversation, I'm sure. It's really probably the toughest time in a tennis player's career to finally decide to retire. What was that decision like for you? I think I read that you had tried to finish up your career in Australia and you asked for a wild card and they denied you back in 2017. And you know, we'll end with Sevastova, I guess, in Australia as your last match there. But why did you decide to retire and that it was time?
I retired. So I played Australian Open, and then I was supposed to play Fed Cup in 2016. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the morning before I played Sevastova, I was warming up for that match and something happened to my back. And I didn't want to let anybody down. So I asked if they can do something so I can actually walk on that court to play the match. But I was in such a pain that I had no way. I couldn't even get in a car, let alone to try to swing a tennis racket. Like, I should have never walked there, but I didn't want to give up. I didn't want to quit and have like just an excuse that people can use against me. Oh, well, she didn't win again, so she's, you know, so and so. Then I went to get a MRI and I had a herniated disc in my back. Mm-hmm. Then I flew back to States to where my husband was, and I did more, I saw more people there. I had to pull out of Fed Cup, and which caused another issue because I was supposed to be, I think, the number one in the team, and they were playing in Slovakia. So people thought I pulled out because I didn't want to go home, which is not true. Like, my dad and my grandparents, my cousins, they're ecstatic for the fact that I was coming to play home, which I haven't played there since I was like 12. So I would have done that, but it just, my back, I could barely sit, let alone for me to move anywhere. And after that, they told me to, I need to get some cortisone injections. I need to take some time off and so forth. And they keep giving them to me every few weeks, but it hurts so bad that I refuse to then have to take them because my back hurts way more afterwards. So then at the end, they did another MRI and they find out I have a second herniated disc. So I have one between my shoulder blades and one just above your tailbone. So it's pretty much from swinging side to side and from serving this way, right? So after that, when they told me that, the guy said, you can have a surgery, but I can't promise you get to play on the level, or if it's going to be even fixed, if you'll be pain-free, I can't promise you that. And after that sentence, he told me in September, I tried to play the tournament in DC because we were living in DC at the time. I played singles, managed to go through it, but after like 3 hour match, I was supposed to play doubles, and the same thing, my bag just went like that and I couldn't get up, and I had to actually drive myself home. I was like, oh, this is not funny. And after that, when I stopped, we were driving with my husband, and I told him, like, I think I'm gonna retire. And I think once I said it out loud that I didn't have it in me to go through another surgery, another rehab, another preseason, another but I knew that I don't have that in me, that power, that drive, because after all the injuries and surgeries and everything that my body and I went through, and mentally over the 16 years I played, I think that was like the last hurrah. And I tried, that's why I want to finish in Australia, because I think I would have had enough for maybe two, you know, matches or something. Yeah. And unfortunately they said no. And they said that I can only, if I play doubles with somebody from Australia, that they will give me for that. And I didn't want to, because my main goal was always to play singles, doubles, more fun learning experience. And that didn't happen. So I was very disappointed, because it's been my home and I represented it the best way I could in every possible competition I could. And so, you know, it was disappointing, but then my husband took me on my retirement tour through Australia and New Zealand, and I had the best time ever.
We finish up today with such a great career, really. Well done to you. And so many ups and downs. We talked about looking back and regrets, and there are many things that maybe you would do differently. And we can always just say, if I had done it differently, maybe it wouldn't have the outcome that I have today, right? So we can always look back and say, so it is what it is. So we'll save regrets for another time, another tennis therapy session.
Well, the regrets are, what are you going to do about them? You can regret it all you want. It's just going to make you sad instead of looking at the right things that happened and the outcome that happened. I was where I was. I met my husband. I got to retire in peace. I have two beautiful kids. Regrets? Yeah, sure. But they don't outweigh all the positive stuff out of it.
You brought so much joy and so much happiness to fans from all over the world. So I can't thank Jarmila Wolf enough for joining me today. It's been so much fun reminiscing, and it's been really important to hear stories like this from players that you would never know the backstory otherwise. So I can't thank you for being so vulnerable. I highly recommend you following her journey on social media. You can follow her on Instagram at jarmila.wolf. That's JARMILA.WOLFE. Thank you so much. Welcome back anytime. Anytime.
Anytime you want me.
While you're on Instagram, shoot me a DM at John Garica and let me know who you're a big fan of and who you'd like to hear on an upcoming show. Also, don't forget to follow us at Fantastic Tennis Pod or on Twitter at FanTennisPod. My name is John Garica, and thank you for listening. This has been fantastic.
Ha 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 ha.